Hey guys, Eric back with you with Flatbridge Ed. This morning I'd like to talk to you all about entitled CO2 and the indications and contraindications, if there is any, regarding the use. I think it's one of the most essential tools that we have now in EMS. I just taught an AMLS class last week and had many questions regarding this, and it seems to me that there's still a lot of misconceptions, a lot of misunderstanding, and a lot of people that don't understand the usage of entitled CO2 and how it can benefit us in our patient care. I also spoke at a conference the last few days and did a ventilator management lecture. And hit on these things real briefly, but again fielded quite a few questions regarding this topic, so I felt it fitting that we put out a quick podcast on entitled CO2. Like many of my podcasts, I want to start off with a quick scenario. It'll build on other podcasts that we have completed. So this is going to be a ventilator dependent patient. I'm just going to spit out some vent settings, so if you have a piece of paper you can write these down. Give you some vital signs, and we'll talk about any vent changes that we may want to make based on those parameters, or identify any problems that you may see with this patient. So we'll start out. You have an 80 kilogram patient. That's ideal body weight. The patient's on a pressure control ventilation assist control at a rate of 14, tidal volume of 480, FiO2 of 50%, and a PEEP of 5. Currently, entitled CO2 waveform is present, and you're getting a quantitative number of 15. Vital signs at this time, you have a blood pressure of 70 over 36, a heart rate of 135, and a temperature of 99.2. If you were going to make any vent changes or you identify any problems, what problems do you see with these settings? So we'll stop there and then we'll come back to this scenario. What types of ways do we confirm tube placement? And we've learned that throughout the years that we always want to listen to lung sounds, we want to watch the ET tube pass through the cords, that we understand that the litigation liability aspect of airway management is huge. And over the last 10 or 12 years, capnography has come into play. I started my career in Oregon and started utilizing capnography in early 2000-2001. As I have moved across the country and worked for different services, that technology is still becoming present in agencies today. They're just now utilizing this technology. For me, utilizing that technology 10, 11 years ago and seeing services now in these rural areas just now getting this technology, it's kind of hard to fathom because it just seems to me it's a part of my toolbox that I've always utilized. So I want to share this information with everybody. So back to how we confirm tube placement. We confirm tube placement by watching it go through the cords. And historically, we always used a qualitative device. And that qualitative device would be an EasyCap. And we know that by ventilating through this device, it changes the litmus paper to a different color that confirms exhaled carbon dioxide. And we know that based on the exhaled carbon dioxide, the litmus paper is going to change and we would confirm that we have good tube placement. So at this point, we identify based on the color metric device that we have good tube placement. We're going to secure our tube and we're going to identify based on that current changes. Now there's problems with qualitative devices. If we vomit, if the patient's got blood in the airway, if they've had a lot of gastric air put in, it can give you a false positive. And I think I've discussed this in previous podcasts. And so you need at least 6 breaths to have litmus paper change that's going to confirm exhaled carbon dioxide. But remember, this litmus paper doesn't do well with any acid. And so if you get blood on it, you get vomit on it, things like that, it's not going to give you a correct reading. So that's where quantitative capnography comes in. Quantitative capnography now is become the mainstay in tube placement. And really when I teach intubation and I teach airway management, I've gotten to where I don't even want the clinician to tell me about lung sounds or epigastric sounds. That's the key indicator for me. I want them to put on that capnography cable and cap that's going to give you a quantitative waveform and number. And this is going to be 100% indicative. So why is this so important? Well, in this day and age when we have so many people wanting to sue and we have the malpractice problems around the country, around the world that have skyrocketed, we need to do anything we can to, number one, protect us, protect our license. Number two, protect the patient. Anything we can do to confirm that we have a good airway, airway is number one, is going to benefit us and the patient. And I think we need to always be thinking that way. So I teach that we need to set up our equipment, and that is one of the biggest things to set up and have ready. So I always teach to have that cable with the cap hooked to the cable. If you're using different monitors, you're either going to have a cap hooked to a cable or the cap is actually connected to the cable already. But whatever machine you're utilizing, have it sitting on the chest, and whoever's performing the intubation, immediately once the tube stylet is removed and you've inflated the cuff, you put that cable on top of the ET tube before you do any ventilations. And that's going to immediately give you a waveform and a number. It's instantaneous. If you lose an ET tube based on movement, based on anything that happens, it's going to be instantaneous as well. So in the past, if you had lost an ET tube and you had a patient that didn't have any shunt in the lungs, they were ventilating and perfusing appropriately, they may hold an O2 sat for a few minutes before you ever identified that you had lost an ET tube. And then at that point, you know, you start having some hypoxia problems and you might have some heart rate changes, cardiac output changes, and then you're kind of way behind the eight ball. So quantitative capnography is the mainstay, and it is an absolute must on all intubated patients. What else does this technology tell you? Well, it's a direct indicator for cardiac output. Remember from my earlier podcast when we talked about cellular respiration, we talked about everything oxygenation. You have this big alveolar membrane, and we want to optimize the surface area of this alveolar membrane. And we know that everything we do oxygenation-wise, we go from a higher concentration to a lower concentration. Anything that impedes that is caused from a ventilation-perfusion mismatch or a shunt. So if you remember, we have surface area in our lungs that are maybe overventilated and underperfused, and we have areas in our lungs that are overperfused and underventilated. And we want to maintain a homeostasis. We want to make sure that's equaled out as much as possible. If you have an area that has dead space, which dead space means you have maybe poor perfusion to that area, and we know that CO2 is attached to that hemoglobin and it's coming around from the heart, returning from the heart in deoxygenated blood, and you have poor cardiac output, it would be fitting that it's a direct reflection of cardiac output. So if your cardiac output is low and you have maybe a stagnant blood flow, and that's kind of the only way I can explain it, then your carbon dioxide reading is going to be low. So it's actually a better indicator of cardiac output than it is exhaled CO2. This can actually get clinicians in trouble because we utilize this technology more for the airway aspects as it relates to tube placement, and we base this on just numbers. And I think a lot of protocols out there tell us to maintain a end-tidal CO2 quantitative number between 35 and 45. And if you remember from my blood gas and acid-base balance podcast, that's a compensatory range, 35 to 45 millimeters of mercury. That's not a perfect world. You know, our patients are sick. They have shunt. They have ventilator perfusion mismatches. And that's not always easy to do. And so what I've seen in the past from especially new flight crew members that are utilizing the ventilator for the first time is they try to maintain that number right in the middle there, and they do whatever they can to do that. Well, there's problems to that. You got to look at the big picture. You got to look at everything that the patient's going through as far as their pathophysiology. Look at their ventilator settings. You look at their blood pressure, their hemodynamic status, and then you make an assumption based on those parameters of, is this end-tidal CO2 waveform indicative of my ventilator strategy, my settings, or is this indicative of my cardiac output and the hemodynamic status? And I still utilize this scenario that we represented in the beginning of this podcast. And there's experienced people out there that will get tunnel visioned, and you know I'm guilty of these things too. I mean I'm not saying that I haven't made the same mistake. That's why I like to teach on things that I have made mistakes on. That you get tunnel visioned on those vent settings, and you think, man, why is my end-tidal CO2 so low? Is it because of my minute ventilation? Is my minute ventilation so high that it's causing my end-tidal CO2 to be low? So how does this all relate to your blood gases? Well, remember from my acid-base balance podcast, your blood gases are reflective of a lot of things. You have your pH, you have your PaCO2, your arterial CO2 concentration, you have your bicarb, you have a base deficit, and you have a PaO2. And remember that your end-tidal CO2 fluctuation can drive your pH up or down based on how it increases or decreases. If you remember from the Winter's formula, a 10-point increase in your end-tidal CO2 will drive your pH down by 0.08. So that's really important. So how can we identify, if we don't have the capability of checking a blood gas, how can we identify what our PaCO2 is? And is it identical to your end-tidal CO2? And the answer is, on a normal patient, it's pretty close. It's, different books tell you anywhere from 3 to 5, 3 to 8 points different difference. So in what way? Well, your arterial concentration of CO2 is never going to be lower than your end-tidal CO2. And so you can always kind of gauge where your PaCO2 is based on your end-tidal CO2. So let's say you have an end-tidal CO2 of 30. You know that your PaCO2, your arterial concentration of CO2, is going to be at least 30. It may be higher than that. You know, it may be 5 points higher in a normal patient, but it's never going to be lower than your end-tidal CO2. So that's a good way to identify, without a blood gas, where your PaCO2 is. In our patients that are sick, even with a patient with a shunt of 10%, and remember what a shunt is. A shunt, if you think about that glass door, you think about that alveolar membrane, you wipe mayonnaise over 10% of that area, that's a shunt of 10%. You're impeding gas exchange, you're impeding diffusion. So just a shunt of 10% will reduce your correlation between PaCO2 and end-tidal CO2 by 30%. I think the ratio is you'll get 70% of what you normally would. So just reduce it by 30%. So it can cause a difference in those numbers very quickly with a little bit of a shunt. So you have two things there, right? I mean, you have cardiac output, and you have anything that's going to cause shunt is going to give you a different correlation of arterial PaCO2 and end-tidal CO2. So how do we maintain that in a good range? Well, again, we need to have good ventilator strategies. We need to make sure that we are optimizing our minute ventilation. We're overcoming dead space based on the 120 cc's a kilogram a minute. You can refer back to the 3-part ventilator podcast, and I explain that in depth. That's going to give you a good minute ventilation based on the ARDSnet study and their strategy of overcoming dead space. And we explain that in depth in the 3-part ventilator podcast. And you just want to maintain an end-tidal CO2 or eucapnia in that compensatory range if you can. Remember, a lot of your patients are sick, and they may have an end-tidal CO2 or a PaCO2 that's higher, you know, in your COPD asthma patients that live at a higher range. So don't get so sucked in that you're going to get that number down to a 35 or 45 range. You may not do that during your flight or during the period that you have your patients. Just remember that quantitative capnography is a mainstay. It's a direct reflection of exhaled CO2, and it's a direct reflection, even more so, of cardiac output. Another example of this cardiac output theory is AHA guidelines right now, ACLS and CPR, is teaching to use end-tidal CO2 capnography on every patient that we have in arrest. And whether you're bagging your patient with a King Airway, backup airway, or an ET2, you're supposed to be putting capnography on these patients. And we're taught not to stop for pulse checks. We'll want to do continuous CPR to optimize cardiac output. And so how do you identify if you have a return of spontaneous circulation? Well, if you have a patient that's got a capnography on, you're probably going to have a number in, you know, anywhere in the low teens, you know, 10, 12, 15. And you're doing compressions and you're going along and you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing. You're doing your cycles of CPR 2 minutes at a time. You're identifying any rhythm changes. And let's say you all of a sudden have a sudden spike in end-tidal CO2 and you shoot up from 12 to 28. Well, that's going to be a direct reflection of cardiac output. Something's changed in the body. And if you've maintained good cardiac output based on your CPR and you're only getting an end-tidal CO2 of 12, and then all of a sudden that shoots up to 28, you know that something's happened. And now maybe your heart has kicked in and you've got more cardiac output going on. So this is going to be a direct reflection of return of spontaneous circulation. Now we're taught not to stop CPR at this point. We want to build up aerobic energy. We want to build up the ATP in the heart. And so we're taught to do another 2 minutes of CPR at this point. Build up that cardiac output even more. Help the heart maintain that energy. So that's just an example of, again, cardiac output. And I can't stress that enough, that this is a direct reflection of cardiac output. So if we go back to our patient that we talked about in the beginning, we had an 80-kilogram ideal body weight patient. On pressure control ventilation. So you remember that's a pressure initiated, volume targeted mode of ventilation. This mode of ventilation is based on compliance. Assist control at 14, so respirator rate of 14, tidal volume of 480, FiO2 of 50%, and a PEEP of 5. And this patient's getting an end-tidal CO2 waveform based on those parameters of 15. And so we know that that's well below our standard end-tidal CO2. Of 15, or I should say, well below our standard of 35 to 45. We have a blood pressure in the toilet. I believe I said around 60 over, or 70 over 36, somewhere in that range. Heart rate of 130s, temp of 99.2. So based on those parameters, based on that minute ventilation, 480 times 14, you know, you're in the 5 or 6 liters a minute range, probably 6 liters a minute range. So, you know, we're kind of on the low end, really, if you think about accounting for dead space. Are we overventilating our patient? Is our minute ventilation too much? You know, and obviously you're always going to look at those things and you're going to identify if it's too much. Do you have an oxygenation problem? Well, I didn't give you an O2 sat. An O2 sat, we'll say, is 93%. And so an FiO2 of 50% is adequate. Your PEEP is 5. So is your PEEP causing any problems? Well, your blood pressure's in the toilet. And there's arguments for and against PEEP. And we talked about in the ventilator management podcast that, you know, your inspiratory maneuvers, how you deliver that breath, the volume that you give, how quickly you give the breath, recruits alveoli. Your PEEP maintains that recruitment. So, you know, I always say PEEP is a good thing. We have intrinsic PEEP between, you know, 3 and 5 centimeters of water. And so is 5 of PEEP going to cause any increased pressure in the chest? It's going to reduce your hemodynamic status. You know, again, there's arguments for and against. You may get some people that are going to say, yeah, 5 of PEEP may cause some problems. I would have to disagree. I would say that 5 of PEEP is not causing any hemodynamic problems. And so you're maintaining that recruitment. Your alveoli need some type of PEEP to maintain patency and keep those inflated to a point where you're going to optimize diffusion in that surface area. So I would say a PEEP of 5 is going to be appropriate. So what's causing this end-tidal CO2 to be low like this? Well, look at their blood pressure. Remember, this is a direct indication of cardiac output. So if your initial thoughts were to maybe change their minute ventilation, change their vent settings, that would be the wrong answer. You need to, again, look at the big picture, look at the pathophysiology related to this patient, identify, is my cardiac output adequate enough to give me a correct end-tidal CO2 quantitative number? And the answer is no. We would want to start treatment to improve cardiac output. So increase volume, give some fluid challenges, maybe even start some pressors based on this patient. You know, is this patient septic? Would they benefit from neosinephrine and maybe dobutamine? Remember, dobutamine is never going to be given by itself. So you want to fill the container first. Start an alpha pressor like levofed. And, you know, if you wanted an inotropic medication piggybacked onto that, dobutamine would be a good one. You could definitely leave that out of your toolbox, and you could go right to neosinephrine, something else that's very alpha stimulant, and it's not going to affect heart rate at all. So optimize cardiac output, and I think if you optimize the cardiac output, your patient's going to benefit from that, and you're going to start seeing an increase in end-tidal CO2 to a normal range. The other things I've seen clinicians do based on end-tidal CO2 is this. You're flying along and you have a patient that is, let's say their end-tidal CO2 is high. So the same patient, but your end-tidal CO2 is 55. And they're so worried about maintaining an end-tidal CO2 in that 35 and 45 range. Maybe they're afraid of medical direction. They're afraid of getting their chart ripped apart by whoever. So they start tweaking numbers on the ventilator, and they get confused. And a lot of people, based on their inexperience, will take them off the ventilator, and they'll start bagging their patients. Well, if you remember from earlier podcasts, we talked about something called the oxyhemoglobin disassociation curve. And this curve is representative of how we uptake and utilize oxygen to our tissues. How much oxygen is attached to our hemoglobin, and how does that hemoglobin separate from your oxygen molecule, and how is it delivered to our tissues? Now, we have a normal curve, we have a right curve and a left curve. And so remember, a right curve is your oxygen molecule attaches to the hemoglobin, your 2-3 DPG, which is that crowbar that pops off that oxygen molecule, will dump off that oxygen molecule off of that hemoglobin as quickly as it attaches. So it's dropping it off as fast as it gets it. The problem with that is that you have a low O2 sat. Remember, your O2 attached to your hemoglobin is actually what your SpO2 is. And so you're going to have a lower O2 sat, and you have a great tissue oxygenation. So your patient's benefiting from that to a point. Okay, so that's not as bad as what we're talking about. But if you had a patient with an end-tidal CO2 of 50, 55, and you start bagging that patient, what are you doing? You're blowing off acid. Remember, CO2 is an acid, so you're reducing acid. If you reduce acid, a left shift on the hemoglobin curve is indicative of low acid and alkalotic state. So everything low, low temperature, low 2-3 DPG, low acid, low pH, high pH. A high pH is going to be low acid, so alkalosis. And what you're going to do is you're going to start driving that shift to the left. So what does that do to our oxygen uptake and delivery? Well, we know with a left shift is we have that same theory. We have oxygen that attaches to the hemoglobin, and now that hemoglobin doesn't have those crowbars to pop them off. Remember, we have low 2-3 DPG. And so your hemoglobin molecules hoard all these oxygen molecules. Well, now we have kind of a flip. We have an increased SpO2 because we have all these hemoglobin molecules that are engorged with oxygen molecules, but the hemoglobin doesn't want to release them to the tissues. So now we have great SpO2 and we have poor tissue oxygenation. So just by switching off from the ventilator and trying to affect change with that end-tidal CO2 the wrong way, and you're starting to bag your patient quicker to hyperventilate to get that down, you've now effectively went from a high enriched tissue oxygenation state, and you're driving that shift from a right shift to a left shift. Now, obviously, we want our curve to be in the normal range, which is indicative of a perfect pH and a perfect, you know, end-tidal CO2 number. That's in the perfect realm with a patient that's not sick. We're dealing with patients that are sick. So remember, don't get so sucked into a number. Treat your patient. Don't worry about those things. Just document what you're doing. Document that you attempted to maintain a minute ventilation, that you attempted to maybe bring that end-tidal CO2 down to a normal range. Identify that you understand the pathophysiology as it relates to cardiac output, and that maybe you're never going to get a patient's end-tidal CO2 above, you know, 15 or 20 because our blood pressure is in the toilet. So attempt to correct the cardiac output. Look at the big picture. So that's all I have for this podcast. I know, you know, it's about 25, 28 minutes. I know it was a little bit longer than the last few. This is important stuff. Remember to utilize your end-tidal CO2 capnography. If you don't have quantitative capnography, you know, talk to your training officer, talk to your director. This has to be on your ambulances. This is the mainstay. This is what is expected nowadays. Remember, qualitative is a good backup. It's not utilized much anymore. It does have its benefits as far as it's very quick. You can put it on, but remember there's problems with it. Understand the correlation between end-tidal CO2 and arterial PaCO2, and that your PaCO2 is never going to be lower than your end-tidal CO2, that your end-tidal CO2 is going to be a good gauge of where your arterial CO2 is, and you can, you know, titrate that. Remember the Winner's formula as it relates to end-tidal CO2 and that level of increase or decrease, how it's going to affect your pH and how you can directly affect change in your patient. And then remember, cardiac output is a big indicator for end-tidal CO2, and to always remember that when you have a low end-tidal CO2. So that's all I have for this. Thank you so much for everybody for the feedback, for enrolling in all our review courses. Thank you for the kind words. People have emailed me regarding the conference the last few days. So we really appreciate that, and we look forward to talking to you guys soon. Thanks so much.